All right, so hopefully this isn't the one that gets us canceled. I was thinking about calling this dating advice for acupuncturists. Maybe we should just say how to build rapport in the clinic.
I think that's a good one. Dating advice for acupuncturists is a persnickety area.
But the reason I bring this up is I've talked about this in other places before, and I feel like, at least to me, there is some overlap between going on a first date and seeing a patient for the first time. Like when you go on a first date, it's like you're really nervous. You want to make a good impression. You want to establish a connection. You want the person to come back for a second date. And I feel like that kind of overlaps with seeing a patient for the first time. And some of those skills overlap as well. And now, just to be clear, I'm not like, don't date your patients. That's not what we're talking about here.
Do not do that. Ethically, do not do that.
But I do feel like some of those skills do overlap. And I think in a previous conversation, you let slip that before Chinese medicine, you were a dating coach. So I thought it might be good to get your take on this. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think one of the first things we have to look at is, one, we're talking about general social skills. Social skills are translatable to anything you do. And it's going to be particularly a point where your interactions with people, like sales, marketing being more of the strategy, but at least on the sales and interaction pieces, that's all you do as an acupuncturist. If the client doesn't like you, it's already going to make a huge problem in terms of your clinical success rates. So this is where you have to be able to build rapport, build some sort of connection with your client. So they're like, okay, you're not a dick, right? Because if they're thinking this person's a jerk, I don't want to see them again. Doesn't matter what Qigong you do. Doesn't matter what techniques you do. They're not coming back to see you. That first impression, like as they would say, you can't make a new first impression. It happens once and that's it. So whatever you get is whatever you get there. So this is where from a rapport standard, it's, well, figure out who you're talking to. Because I've had people come through the door and they'll talk things and, I'll adjust the language. Where if I know they're more scientific, for example, I'm going to talk more science language terms. If they're coming from an artsy background, I'm using artsy terms. If they're using more energy work or spiritual terms, I'll use that. Because their map, the map that the patient has, is their reality. And if you oppose that, what happens? That means you're not connecting to them and you don't get them. If you don't get them and you're healing them for a shoulder pain or whatever ailment they come in for, they're not going to want to work with you at that point because you're not in their world. You don't get where they're coming from.
Yeah, it's kind of like meeting the patient where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of some background on this. Before I got into Chinese medicine, for my undergrad, I studied mathematics and computer engineering. And so, as you can imagine, computer engineers don't necessarily have the reputation of being really good with people. And so when I got into TCM, I knew that this was going to be a deficit for me, that I think when I first started out, I had this idea that as long as my skills were good enough, that as long as I got results in the clinic, that would be enough, that people would come running to see me because of the results that I got. But as I started treating patients, I realized that that's not actually true, that a lot of what makes people come back is the connection they form with you. And I realized that I did not have those skills. So I think it's kind of like almost like they say in sales that in order for someone to buy from you, they have to know, like, and trust you. And I did not have those skills of having people know, like, and trust me. And it was something that I consciously had to work on.
Right. And I mean, I'm in the same boat here with Nicholas. It's like, I did apprenticeships and things like that. And from a social structure in China historically, when you're talking about like family lineages or imperial doctors or things like this, the pedigree was you had to get results. We don't care how good your social network was because you're treating the emperor or you're treating aristocrats or you're treating people in general. So if you couldn't produce it, guess what? You're replaced and you'd probably be blacklisted if you didn't have the skill sets. However, there was an unspoken rule with all that, which was everyone understands Chinese social norms, which are different value sets than Western norms in some ways. So if you got a referral from somebody in a Chinese cultural standard, you basically were like the boss boss person because they tested you ahead of time. They qualified you ahead of time by your reputation, by your family lineage, by whatever it was. So they already bought into the treatment ahead of time. Do we have that here in Western culture? Well, we do and we don't. If it's a reference from a friend, we know it's stronger, but that's not how most people are making their bread and butter in a clinical standard. You're getting it mostly through cold approaches, as I would call it, cold calls, where people would just say, hey, I found you on Google, or maybe we saw you on YouTube. I've had people said that even for the Qigong videos. They're like, oh, we saw you on YouTube. We totally like talked about Qigong. We feel like we have a connection on things. But that's a little bit different. That's a reputation preceding me now because I have a visual content. Much like Nicholas here has, everyone knows him as a YouTube superstar for TCL. So this is like the reputation precedes you, but if we both didn't have social platforms or we didn't do this podcasting or anything like that, we'd be like, no one would know us. And then now we got to do marketing of the clinic or our social services in a different way. So this is from the rapport standard. We're already doing the pre-work here.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like we've already created a first impression. So that gives us an advantage here. And I suppose maybe you could do the same thing by having a website that introduces yourself and having some testimonials that can start to give a first impression.
Absolutely. And then this is going back to who do you serve? This is talking about demographics, and everyone's like, well, you know, what do you mean demographics? We don't get all technical around things. However, it's true. You're not going to be able to serve everybody. So even from the dating point when I was working with people, I make them analyze themselves and be like, well, who would fit your life? If you're like an engineered person and you want a punk rocker, but you don't like punk rock, it's going to be a hard fit here, right? So your values as a practitioner definitely are going to be seen through from your clients. Like, it's pretty well known here for our client base, they want coaching. They want lifestyle coaching to make the best life that they can get through Chinese medicine techniques. And that means we're doing holistic care across the board. This is the spiritual side. This is the mundane physical side, but it's everything. That's really what we provide here. That's different than everybody else for differentiations. So I'm congruent at that point. So people, when they discuss things with me, I'm like, yeah, this is how you do it, because I've gone through the experience. I've walked through that door. And it's not this analogy I use all the time. It's not, I'm saying, this is the most awesome place ever. Look at this. This is like this dark room, no lights on, has a gold fountain. It has all Santa Claus presents, whatever it is. This is the most awesome room. But trust me, you should go in first. No one's going to trust you at any point. So at that point, you have to go in first, turn on the light and say, see how amazing this room is. This is your call card, essentially. But if you don't have the experiences and you can't link into it, where you're telling your own narrative and your own story, people don't know how to connect with you then. And then they can't say, hey, is this person the right person for me as a practitioner?
Yeah, and I guess I could see that when we were talking about Imperial China, I could see a situation where you're actually not supposed to talk to the patient, like if you're correct, dealing with someone of high status. But in the same way that if you were a medical doctor 50 years ago, you just had so much authority that you didn't have to connect with a patient. You were just automatically seen as an authority. And I think that's something that we don't have. But anyway, about halfway through school, about the same time I started seeing patients, I started going on a lot of first dates. And so that's kind of how I kind of developed this theory that maybe some of the skills I was practicing in the dating world could be applied to seeing patients for the first time. And maybe I'll just throw out some examples and you can tell me what you think of them.
Sure.
So this was like, I had a very engineer nerdy approach to it. I was like, I'm going to go online and research all these dating tips. And one of them was this concept of eliciting values. Mm-hmm. And so when I try to explain this to people, I think maybe the best example I can give is, have you ever gone on a first date and it feels like you're being interviewed? Like you sit across from each other and you're just kind of like, where are you from? How many siblings do you have? What's your favorite type of music? What is your occupation? And it's like, this is really good if you're like trying to compile a dossier on someone.
It is.
But it doesn't really help to make a connection. And so this idea of listening values is, instead of getting factual information, try to ask questions that get values or opinions. So like one way I'd do this is I would start out by asking, you know, what do you do? What's your job? What's your occupation? And that's like a simple one-word answer. But then I would follow up by saying, is that something you enjoy? How did you get into it? Is this something that you're really passionate about? Or is it just something that you're doing to pay the bills? And so that way you're getting more into the value system of the other person. And I've seen this happen in the clinic too. I actually kind of stole this from a J.R. Worsley five element practitioner because I think they do a lot of rapport building. And this, he would say things like, where are you from? And they say, oh, I'm from the small town. And they say, what do you like about it? Or what's so good about it? Even if people came up to him and said, good morning, he'd be like, what's so good about it? And it's kind of a little bit sarcastic, but it's also a good way of eliciting values.
Well, it's eliciting values and the point of like, what is a value of a motive quality? I think like, let's break down the value piece because you said eliciting means you essentially are trying to open up the door so they can provide their own experience that you can relate with. So when you're saying what's good about the morning, because it's a default behavior people have, they'll say good morning and automatically you're like good morning, but is it good? This is like what makes it good? Was it the coffee? Was it that you got up today? Like that, it could be as simple as that, right? So this is where when that rapport build of listening values means I can connect with you on a level that you actually value. We are on the same team. This gets into a us versus them mentality, which, you know, business psychology talks about this all the time, but this is just social communications also. We as people, like, you know, let's even take us, for example. It's like, all right, we're TCM people. That means we by default aren't what? XXXXX. Name whatever role you want to be in. So we're on the same team. That means we have something in common. If we have one thing in common, it most likely means we have multiple things in common, whether it be philosophy, outlooks of life, whatever it is. And then from there, your goal as a practitioner is essentially you're supposed to be connecting to everyone, in my opinion. So I'll switch my language all the time. And people have seen this when I run certain clinics. They're like, did you just like switch into like, I'm like, absolutely. If someone's coming in from a working class perspective, like let's just say they're a driver. This is where I'm going to be like, okay, long day on the road, all this stuff. And I'm going to start, I would call them scripts, but they're not scripts. They're my experiences that I've actually analyzed to communicate. So it's on repeat. They're my own personal stories. So this is not a lie per se, but they are in a way that I am able to pull them up at any point. If you say anything to me, I have something in to engage with. So if someone's coming in from a high CEO perspective, I'm like, all right, you want numbers, you want X around statistics. We're going to have those conversations more. If I'm talking to an artistic person that loves the arts and that's what they do at living, I'd be like, it's hard to make an art living. It's hard. Like, are you a visual artist or are you a musician? That's already a big piece. When people say arts, it's a general piece. Is it visuals or is it music? They're both arts. But I'll tell you right now, between those two viewpoints of arts, radically different approaches to life. So if I started talking to musicians, I'd be like, okay, the stereo, the rock concerts, the punk rock metal scenes I've been in, right? You blow up your eardrums because you're too close, because you're getting older. All right, this is why it happens. The vibration of the sounds replicates through your body, and this is why you're having ear damage, possibly with the eardrums, right? If it's an artist type person, I'll start descriptively painting the words. I'd be like, is it oil or is it water painting? Again, I used to really do a lot of art stuff for visuals. So I understand the nuances of like the different art pieces. I'm like, are you abstract or are you more realism? It makes a big difference the way you describe things. So as soon as I start pinpointing the value pieces, I'll be like, it's like this. And having worked with a visual artist recently, I might say, well, all right. So imagine your body is a canvas and the canvas is you have some murky colors. How do you transform those colors? Well, you have to paint them and add other secondary colors and then you work with it from there. Then they're like, oh, so how does this work with my back pain? I'd say, well, the back pain here is a splotch. Just assume that I just randomly threw some paint at it. How do you make this better? Well, it has certain correlations, blah, 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 right? So this is where changing your language, changing your body language even. Like, we're talking about listing values, but this is also with rapport particularly. We would be actually doing similar body language. We call this mirroring, essentially. So this is where, you know, you and me are doing it right now because we're good friends. We know each other on things. So this is where, like, you know, he nods his head, I nod my head. We're kind of doing the same body pieces, but that builds a connection there also. So this is where you can do that with your clients, where if they come in and if I were to context it, say I'm a 6'2" dude, I'm big. And if I have a very tiny female, let's say 5'4", my body language is working against me completely. Like, no female is going to be comfortable with that as a practitioner. So what I generally do is I take a knee and I look at them eye to eye, or I'll sit down and I'll let them stand because it's about the same height. And my body language ends up being open. And then when they actually do say something like a move forward, I'll move forward. And when they move back, I move back. This comes almost like a dance, but everyone does this subconsciously already. If you think about your friends, you think about your family, you all match each other to some level. The difference is I can do it consciously because this was essentially a professional job for me. And I was literally coaching people on it.
Hey, real quick, I just want to let you know about two products you should definitely be aware of. Evil Bone Water and Dragon Blood Balm. These are both topicals and they actually work really well together. We've talked about Evil Bone Water before. It's a high quality, made in America version of Zhengu Shui. It's an alcohol based liniment and it has ingredients like San Qi, so it's really good at invigorating blood and stopping pain. Dragon Blood Balm is a balm with jojoba oil and beeswax as its base. And this one has ingredients like Shui Jie, Ru Xiang, and Mo Yao. So this one invigorates blood and also promotes regeneration of flesh. So this was originally created for rock climbers who tore up their hands and had sore tendons from all the rock climbing. But it's also good for any kind of cracks or sores on the skin. So if you get dry, cracked hands from cold weather or from washing your hands too much, this could be a good solution. And like I said, these two work really well together. You can put the Evil Bone Water on first, and that one has a lot of aromatics that open things up and help things penetrate in. Then after it dries, you can put on the Dragon Blood Balm, and the oil and beeswax will moisturize and kind of put a protective barrier on top. And both of them are good for invigorating blood and healing sinews, muscles, and skin. So if you want to try both together, you can get a bundle pack from the Dragon Blood Balm website. I'll put a link in the show notes with a coupon for 15% off. And if you're a practitioner, these are also great to sell as products in your clinic. So I'll put links to where you can sign up for wholesale accounts in the show notes as well. We've also had Mark Brinson, the creator of Evil Bone Water, on the podcast. So if you want to hear the full story, you can check out Session 14. And I've actually just recorded an episode with one of the creators of Dragon Blood Balm. So that will be coming out next week, so you can keep an eye out for that as well. But let's go ahead and get back to our conversation with Zach. So it sounds like what I'm hearing so far is we want to establish this frame that we're on the same team. That's not like I'm the practitioner and you're the patient. We want to be on the same side of the table, on the same team. And some of the specific strategies you talked about doing that are asking questions about them that gets to their core, but then also disclosing some of your own experiences that relate to where they are. And then also modifying your language or modifying your vocabulary using terms that they're familiar with. So I feel like that's tactically where we're at right now. And then I think what you were getting into is I feel like this might be a technique in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, where they talk about mirroring and leading, where you can start by mirroring a person's body language. And once you create that connection through your mirrored language, you can actually alter your body language and they might start mirroring you. So it's kind of like you can lead them in a certain direction. So I'm not sure I've actually paid attention to this too much, but I think it might be something like if a patient comes in and they're kind of downcast and they're talking kind of quietly, then maybe I'll match my voice that if they're talking slow and quiet, I'll start talking slow and quiet and be like, oh yeah, it's kind of a gloomy day out there, trying to meet them where they're at. Mm-hmm. And then maybe over time kind of open up and talk more excited or something like that. Is that what we're talking about here?
We could go there. That's one strategy you could go. Meet them where they're at, and then it's basically the rule of two steps forward, one step back, right? So you lead them, and you let them lead, and then you keep pulling them forward to where you want them. So it's basically like, okay, you're here, you're kind of gloomy. I'll match your energy, and then we go forward, right? So that is usually a good strategy for most people. The other strategy is you just completely just go hardcore, like it's, I don't want to say college frosh week, but you're really super excitable, golden retriever, and the person's like all gloomy. What happens? Emotions are contagious. So at that point, they have to come up to you, and you don't match them. So this is where now you got to have an honest conversation with yourself on reflections, like what type of person are you? How's your day? If you don't have the energy today to do things, then what's going to happen? Well, you're going to be like, eh. Well, you might actually have to match them, and then you pull them up. But if it's having a good day, there's no reason why you should drop down to them. They'll come up to you a lot faster. But that means you have to hold state, and that's an internal locus control, or that's your frame, as we discussed. A frame generally is what is the context socially that you're trying to set up for both people. So if I'm having a good day and I can lower myself, I could drop my energy level slightly and be like, oh, it's a good day, but they're still going to have to pick up a lot more slack. And then when they match, it'll be like high five. And then you start doing all these body things, right? So for dating, it'd be like, here's a high five, here's a body pivot, whatever it is, right? So this is where in a clinical situation, you still can do that. It's called the table and the entrance. So they come on in, it's a gloomy day, you'd be like, hey, how you doing, so-and-so? And they're like, oh, you know, I got back pain, or oh, I got this illness. And be like, oh man, that sucks. It must be hard. And you know the problem. You know these people. If it's brand new, you don't know them. But assuming it's a brand new person, they're like, oh, that sounds like a rough day. How you been keeping with that? And notice how I have a certain pace with my voice. It's like, but that means it started slow, and then now I'm picking up the beat, and then as soon as I pick up the beat, they have to match me. If they're not matching me, then I have to go back and say, hey, it's all right. Have you had Chinese medicine before? And then they might say, no, yes, maybe so. The wording here does not matter so much, right? I could say anything. I'd be like, have you had a Pikachu today? It doesn't matter, right? So this is where this is kind of, you got to listen to the tonality of things. This is now, if you have a musical training, this becomes really fun because then you can oscillate. And it is like a rhythm that you start hitting with your voice. So they come in slow. I'm going to pick it up. If they match me, great. If not, I have to cue down because it might be too intense for them. They might be like, screw it, I'm too tired, man. And they're like, all right. And then I will empathetically from my body language to say, we have a connection. I'd be like, yeah, it's a long day. And then I'm going to start mashing them. But then my goal is really not to get to their state. This is what it means to have a frame control or state control. It's basically you're trying to get them to a positive place in the healing. This usually would actually be talked about in Qigong or Feng Shui therapies. If we were talking about like space allocation. So as soon as someone comes into the space, this gets into things like, well, where are they moving? Is it a closed off space? Is it an open space? Is it bright light? Like these things actually matter in your environment because now you're setting up a different whole situation, which is a whole new experience. So if we take a clinical situation for anybody, person walks through the door, they don't know where you've been, they don't know the building, they might be a new location. That's the first thing. So if I'm in their position, I might say, I don't know this practitioner. I'm invested enough to book a session with them online, or I heard somebody say, so there's a little bit of trust or there's a leap of faith. But, you know, the difference between you're in a back alley going to a clinic versus you going to, like, you know, the Marriott for a treatment. There's two different expectations as soon as you see this. I'd be kind of like, back alley Chinese place. I don't know about this. Right. Versus you're in the Marriott hotel or whatever, like fancy type of clinic. And you're like, oh, wow, this I feel like it's royalty here. That's a very different impression. So you have your front door piece. They enter in and then, are they welcome? Are they greeted? Because as soon as they enter, like think about when you enter a new space, like you go to a store or something, what's the first thing you say? You look around, you see if there's actual people there. That gets into social proofing, as we call it, and group mentalities. So it's like, if it's a clinical piece and you see nobody there, you're like, is this person good? Is this person not good? These are questions that will pop in your head. And then you start looking at the aesthetic. Like as soon as people walk through our studio, you know, we're doing spiritual things. Because you see, essentially, you'll have to walk through essentially our spiritual store. That's not the clinical store. That's not the clinical front. But this is like you do walk through a spiritual store. You know our values right off the bat, right? And it's not saying that you have to be a spiritual person to get treatments here. Absolutely not. But it is something to say this is something we do talk about. And we can go there if you want to. right? So with our clients in particular, they know my background right off the bat. They're like, we came to you because you're a Qigong master. We came to you because you're a shaman and a folk priest. And we're all about this holistic healing from a soul level or a qi level or whatever level. They want the full shebang. So when I start talking about things and the metaphors of life, they're like, yeah, this absolutely connects to me. But they were pre-screened ahead of time, or they were pre-qualified for whatever reason. And it could just be as simple as a Google review, or it could be a YouTube video, or it could be your friend or a family member. But all these things do matter in the context of setting up the space and setting up a narrative, because this is just a story you're doing. And the story that you lead people in makes a huge difference. You, for all intents and purposes, though we're talking about rapport, the rapport has already happened. As the space is the rapport first. So if you have a dirty place that is like unrepresentative of you and your practice, you are incongruent. So if you started saying, hi, we are doing a lot of things here and here's all the science stuff, but you're not that, then people are going to be confused. And if people are confused, they can't trust you. So there's a lot of intricacies on this. And then even just a setup initially for 10 questions, if you do that, or whatever it is, you get them to sit down. What's the seating arrangement? What's the space? What's the lighting? How are you sitting? Because what most people are taught initially is, and I've seen this and I'm like, don't do this. It's during clinic, right? They'll literally be like, hi, how you doing? Right in front of you. And, you know, it's one thing if it's a female doing this, it's another thing if it's a male doing this, but
yeah,
either way,
especially
it's
with
bad.
A female patient. Yeah.
Right. It's bad across the board, because what happens when I sit in front of somebody, even if I'm a female, it comes down to, this is oppositional. We're not friends. I don't know you right now. I trust you enough, but people are like, oh, now you're getting to like this fight or flight. That's what you've established. So your space dynamics matter. You have to go in at a 45 degree angle or 35 degree angle. So I'm always, if someone's here, I might be like, hey, how you doing? And I'm leaning in slightly and I'm talking to them like it's a, we're having a secret here, right? And then I might say, hey, you know, tell me about those bowel movements. And they're like, what? And I'm like, you know, I have to know this. It's your medical health. I need to know this. And then they're like, oh, okay. And then I back off. Because that was a little bit intense. That's a little bit of a personal thing to be like, how's your bowel movements? I mean, hell, their partners don't even know about this. Your family probably doesn't even know about this. That's a very intimate question. So to say, tell me your secret and I'm out, that gives you a space psychologically, emotionally to take that. So this is a side profile where I'm usually going to take a side profile for most people. There are times I will do a front if they do it themselves. So if they end up turning to me, then I will match them. And that's the rapport. They're saying, we're on the same team again. It is a us versus them mentality consistently. And it starts becoming an adventure. And the more times you could have an adventure in your treatments, the better this is going to be. Because it went from what? Your store door or whatever the initial building was. They went through that journey. Then they get to the little waiting room area. And then they have to get to the treatment. The treatment's another – that's a third date essentially. You've gone through three different things. So at that point, they have to trust you. And now it's what's your etiquette on the bedside manner. That's a whole different conversation of rapport building. But there's a lot of layers here that people are like, this gets into like retail therapy and all that stuff that people are like, I don't need to do that. It's like you do, because they are looking at the psychology. They are looking at people's reactions are. So all those things do matter. Every single step is either building you up or tearing you down. And the better you can get that control, the better, well, your rapport building is.
Yeah, I feel like that was something I read on the internet back in the day, that like when you go on a date with someone, avoid sitting across from them, because again, it's kind of like an interview type thing, and right. Like try to sit at like a 90 degree on the table or a 45, and then it's more like you're two people hanging out on a couch together. It's more friendly. And so I feel like in this context, it's kind of setting up this frame that, again, we're on the same team, that there's a collaboration rather than just a face-to-face interview. So it sounds like we talked about some mirroring and leading, where it's you can either match the person and then try to guide them in a direction. So if they come in all gloomy, you can start off all gloomy and do a two steps forward, one step back. Or you can just come in with the exact opposite. You could, if they're kind of gloomy, you could do a cartwheel and say, "Hey, how's it going? Everything's great. I'm too blessed to be stressed," and hopefully pull them back up. I can see that backfiring as well, but
it can.
That's another thing. And I guess I should say that there's probably a lot of people that, like, this stuff is obvious. This is just like how you be a normal human being. But again, when you, like, when you come from a computer programming background and you don't have these people skills, this is the kind of stuff I actually had to analyze and really look at to see, like, what's the proper strategy. Another thing we mentioned in there is this idea of frame. And I think this is an important one, not just in establishing rapport, but one of the things I hear in the clinic that I really hate is I have a lot of new students who would say, "Fake it till you make it." And I never really liked that phrase. Yeah. It sounds kind of like you don't have confidence, you're kind of deceitful, you're faking it. So what I like better is that phrase of control the frame. And this is maybe difficult to explain to people, but sometimes the way I think of it is when we say frame, that's each individual's subjective interpretation of an objective reality. So let's just assume temporarily that there is such a thing as an objective reality that is the same for everybody. I think quantum physics might disagree with it, but let's just say there's such a thing as an objective reality. Even if that's true, each person will experience that reality differently. I mean, it could be that just people take in different information through different senses. So they'll be getting different information. But more importantly, all that information is filtered through their background experiences, their conditioning of what they've been punished or rewarded for, that there's all these background experiences that color that objective reality. So they have a subjective interpretation. And where this gets really interesting is if there's more than one person in the room, it's like whoever has the strongest frame wins, or whoever has the strongest sense of reality, that you can pull other people into that reality. Right. And so I think the easy example of this would be if you go to a party and you're wearing like a stupid hat or something like that. If you believe in the core of your being that this silly looking hat is the coolest thing in the world, you can pull other people into that reality and they will also believe it's the coolest thing in the
Correct.
World.
Correct.
Whereas if you're really self-conscious and you think, "Oh, this hat makes me look dumb. People are going to laugh at me." Then other people will pick up on your body language and your cues, and they'll fall into that reality of this hat is stupid, we're going to laugh at him. Or this is like when people get backstage at a concert, even though they don't have backstage tickets, they're just like, just act like you belong and everyone will assume that you actually belong. It's like you're creating a strong reality and pulling people into it. Circling this back to a clinical perspective, I think that this is actually a better way to think about it rather than fake it till you make it, is you can control the frame, that because you're the person in charge, you're wearing the lab coat, people will automatically default to your version of reality. And so you have to be careful about maintaining the Correct. Reality that you want.
And this is important because what you mentioned here is the white lab jacket, right? That's already a presupposition where there's an assumption there that a white jacket is professional because it is working on the lines of you're a medical person. Now, in China, we know historically at the current point in time that medical doctors have to be your foundation before you become a TCM person. Like, it's actually a prerequisite. You're an MD before you're a TCM in China. There are some exceptions to that rule, but the majority is you are an MD. So for them to wear a white lab jacket shows authority. Now, what are we in the West? Are we authority figures? I'll be the first one to say, hell no, you're not. Right? So you trying to get authority wearing a nice white lab jacket? Well, no, it's not going to happen. It looks like you're a punk and not a good one. Right? So this is where people are like, "Oh, I'm more professional, I'm more clean." And I'd say, yes, you are. But is that the impression you want? Because people come to us because they don't want to deal with MDs, because they've been more or less screwed by the medical system for whatever reason. So you're actually echoing now their fears. When you're in a white jacket, you might act a little bit differently, you might use more language, but then when you start using terms that they don't understand, like here's the chi, here's the blood, here's the yin, you have just extracted yourself to be an MD in their eyes. So this is knowing where your clients are coming from. So even on the frame control piece here is, do I want to associate with that fear? No, I will do something completely different, right? So this is where, I mean, everyone knows me, I wear a three-piece, right? But that's actually what I do in clinic. If it wasn't like for certain things, like right now I'm doing scrubs, but basically it's like people know me for the three-piece and, you know, that's what people came for, essentially. And that's very different compared to what people come in for acupuncturists usually.
Yeah, and I think that's a thing where it's like whatever you do, you can create a reality and draw people into it. So like some people wear scrubs. We in school, we had to wear white lab coats. But like Patrick, on the other hand, he shows up in shorts and flip-flops.
Yeah.
Actually, flip-flops are not ideal when you're dealing with needles, so don't do that.
Yeah,
but
they're not.
He would show up in shorts and flip-flops. But the frame that he creates, is the reality he creates is that I'm so good at what I do, I don't need to impress you with my clothing. It's kind of like when like the truly rich people don't actually show off their bling. And so it's still this idea of creating a reality that he's just so confident in what he does. He can create this reality of, I don't need to wear professional clothing in order to get you to respect me. You respect me because of my skills. So that's a reality he creates. But I think another way that this comes up is sometimes I just get questions like, how do you deal with needling Ren 1? Or what do you? How do you get patients when you have to have them disrobe? How do you handle that? And I think that's a thing where it's like you have to maintain a frame or a state of mind that
you do.
If you're needling Ren 1 and you think this is a good point for them, if you adopt this reality of I'm a medical professional, Ren 1 is a completely normal thing for me to do. This is a point that's very helpful and is going to improve their health and improve their patient outcomes. This is a normal thing. Then you project that reality and the patients will just be like, oh, this is a normal thing. He does it all the time. This isn't weird at all.
Absolutely.
Whereas instead, if you adopt a reality of, oh, Ren 1, that's kind of weird. That's kind of icky. I don't know how I feel about this. Oh, the patient's going to think I'm a weirdo because I suggested doing Ren 1. Well, then the patient is going to be drawn into that reality that you created. And then they're going to be like, oh, this is really uncomfortable. I'm not sure I want to do this. Same thing with I'm like cupping someone's back and I say, oh, you have to disrobe. If I'm like, you know, I did massage for several years. I'm a medical professional. This is something that's really helpful for the patient. This is something I do all the time. I can just say, hey, I want to get to these points on your back. In order to do that, I'm going to need you to pop off your shirt. So I'm going to step out real quick, let you pop off your shirt, get on the table, and then we'll go from there. Then it's like, oh, this is a normal thing that I do all the time. The patient is completely comfortable. If I say, oh, are you okay if we do some stuff on your back? Are you okay taking – is that something you're comfortable with? Then the patient gets drawn into that reality of this is a weird, uncomfortable thing.
Well, we can talk about the reality points, but we'll even talk about the emotions, right? I think that's a much easier way to relate to people. Do you want to hang around with people with anxiety? The answer is usually no. Right. If you want, and if we look at confidence being a motive state, or at least let's say positivity, do you want to hang around positive people? Usually, yes. So even at the true core crux of congruence, it's, are you okay with what you're doing? I think that really is the harder question. So the fake it till you make it, it's like you may be uncomfortable based on certain belief systems you have. Like if a person's dating and they're like, oh, I don't deserve to talk to somebody because I have some fear. That's when the fake it till you make it happen saying, let's assume you're in a different role. Let's put you in a different role that does not have this belief system. And let's get you to believe in that. That's what they mean by fake. Usually it's you're adopting a new belief system where you don't have anything that's actually in conflict to your goal. That's still going to take a little bit of working though. Right? So this is where you have to progressively work with it. So if someone's not good with CV1 or the Ren 1 piece, and you're like, well, here's a needle for your junk. It's like, no, like, it's going to be kind of weird for most people, unless you own it and saying this is appropriate. And that's now you're using authority as a point in the social interaction to say, I know what I'm doing, right? That's an authority play. You could do a different play and say, okay, maybe you're not so comfortable with CV1 and you say, look, I'd like to try something out. Is that okay with you? But you still have to be confident enough to ask the question, right? But if you're like, oh, well, CV1, it could be okay for you. It's like, sir, can I have some more food? Like, it's that type of mentality. you're not going to get the response from people unless now it gets to a point of like, they're going to be like, you're trained. Why are you so deferent to me?
Yeah.
Right. So this is where it's actually okay if you're unconfident. Call it out. It'd be like, look, it's a new point. It's a new treatment. Are you okay with this? I don't know what's going to happen. And frankly, I think it's best for you based on my understanding, but I really don't know. At the point that you own it and you own the fear and you own the, I don't know what's going to happen. Most people are going to be like, look, I trust you enough that I'm here paying you money. If that's what you think, then we'll go with it. But this is now getting to like more self-esteem things and being like, are you comfortable with yourself? You could, for all bluntly, for blunt pieces, I mean, you could fuck up on multiple things. And if you're not comfortable with your fuck up, people are going to be like, you're not comfortable with your fuck up. Right. So, I mean, we're not talking about medical screw ups, mind you. I have to be very clear. Right. So this is very much like on the social interaction piece of, well, what's happening? And this also gets to another premise. Your interaction is how they skew you. So that's a map of reality now that they're always going to see you through that filter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it could actually be really nice if you were like, yeah, I don't really know what the hell I'm doing. That's quite refreshing for most people, actually. Saying like, you could be that vulnerable and be like, I don't know what's going to happen, but I do think this is best based on my understanding. But that means, again, you're okay with you saying that.
Yeah, I feel like this is a thing where it's like the way to get rid of shame is to shine a light on it. And so it's like, yeah. if it's a situation where it's like, I don't know what I'm doing. If you admit that, that's better than trying to half-assedly fake it and trying to like it's just better to be upfront with it.
It's better to be upfront with it, but this comes down to who are you? And this is kind of like the piece. It's like you could get away with a bluff. If you are confident enough and you're like, it's done, you could bluff it, even though you're like, man, what the hell did I just do? I completely bullshitted this. And people are still taking it and be like, yeah, you got it. But that's you having core confidence or you having a core belief in yourself that you'll make it no matter what. So there's a prerequisite to do the bluff, right? If you don't have that core confidence and that prerequisite, then you would have to actually, from a social context, admit you're like, I don't know what I'm doing. And that will play off and people will be like, okay, then why don't we help you? But in both frames, you can see that it's either essentially a domination / we're on the same team and I'm your true leader, or, and you know, we're all awesome together, or I don't know, can you help me out? Both are psychology tactics we can use in sales, right? So there's a lot more we can go with, but again, it really keeps going back to this. Do you know yourself? And you don't have to be perfect.
Yeah, and I feel like sometimes I've gone too far the other way. Like there have been times where like I've been really nervous about needling kidney one. And so it's like, oh, I really want to prepare the patient that like, oh, you got a lot of nerving endings on your feet. This might be a very uncomfortable point, but I think it's going to be really good for you. But I just want to make sure that you're okay because this might be a painful thing. And like I build up this reality of this is going to be a terrible experience.
Yeah.
And then I do it and they're like, oh, that was totally fine. That was nothing. And yeah. It's kind of like I caused undue stress because of my lack of confidence actually made the situation worse by causing that stress.
And that's a maybe, maybe not, right? Like from the psychology point of the buildup, you essentially got them up and then you essentially said, here's the crescendo point, we're done. But you made them go through all the stress initially and you built it up to a point that they're like, oh, this is nothing.
Oh yeah, it's like setting expectations low and then exceeding them. I did the opposite of setting the bad expectations high and then like coming in below it. Another thing we mentioned in there is this idea of social proof. And I think in the dating world, this might have some specific meanings in terms of using external factors to convince people you're not a weirdo, I guess. I don't know a good way to describe it.
The best way I would describe it is social proof is not groupthink, but it is an idea of working with your external environment so people can qualify you, right? So we're going back to those elicited values. You're showing your elicited values through the people you hang out with, the environment you're in, and they actually say something about you.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of ways we could incorporate in this into the clinic. Like the obvious things that come to mind is like if you had a bunch of testimonials and reviews, like if a person walked in and they saw a wall of 55 star reviews that you've printed out from Yelp, that would be like that social proof that you get results. And so that would be like one obvious example. I'm trying to think like what are some other ways?
That's an easy one. So let's take community acupuncture, for example. You see 10 people in the room.
Yeah.
Right? That's an easy one. It's a low price point. The value is it's community acupuncture. It's a sliding scale usually. At that point, if you see 10, 20 people in a room and they're flipping over consistently, you're like, this person's probably good and knows what they're doing. Now, if you're brand new, though, where do you get that?
I was going to say, I feel like I've heard this as a tactic where people, like, even if they only have 5 patients a week, they book them all on the same day at the same time. That way, as one patient is walking in, another one's walking out. So correct. Even though you're not actually busy, it looks like you're busy.
Looks like you're busy. And this gets into the reality point.
Yeah, it creates some of that social
right, this proof. Gets into, again, frame control, where it's kind of like, this is a pretty standard tactic with the bigger clinics. Right. Like this is like, here's the red carpet. I'm saying the secrets. It's kind of like, I know when talking to major clinics, they're basically like, yeah, we book everyone at the same time, even if it's a slow day. Why? Because the idea is you're busy. And if you're busy, you'll think you're busy. And if you think you're busy because you're the main common denominator for the clinic.
It's kind of like self-hypnosis too.
It is. So this is where if you're just starting off, book everyone, like have your availabilities, but push everyone into the same day. Like even like applications like JNAP and things like that, they'll be like, do you want to look busy? And they will literally have a thing where they're like, these days are slotted off because you can only come in on this day. Now you're getting to the scarcity mentality of saying you are a hot commodity, which, you know, this gets into FOMO. It's like, oh, I got to get the session with so-and-so at this particular time because that's my time slot. And people will start claiming it too. They're like, I want this time, right? And you'll see that pretty consistently across the board that people start getting defenses on time slots. Like they're like freaking like Pokemon cards. Like, this is my Pokemon. This is my time slot. And I'm like, well, if you don't have it, you don't do it. It's gone. I can't help you. So you have to get it in. So this is important to understand from a social proof standard. If you're just starting off, get people coming at the same time. Now, say that is not an option even on the table. Testimonials is one way. Another way is space. What's the difference between a 500 square space room versus a 200 room? Well, if you have a lot of empty space, the social proof in this context, there's no people, but the space says you're empty, and that's not a good thing. You want a smaller space when you're first starting off. You want a 300 square feet room or maybe 200 because the space is tiny. So that means it's intimate. You build those connections more. And on top of that, there's no empty space. So people don't feel weird where it's like, why do you have this empty space? Because actually, what's the thing that people psychologically do? Empty space, something's wrong, right? Unless it's like it's built in a certain way, but that's not most clinical rooms. So you have that aspect. And then in terms of people, this is where, again, if you're starting to get people to come on through, maybe it's like you have a workshop day. You have a monthly hangout. Whatever it is, you get people coming through the door. People are still people. People will see other people and go, like, oh, all right. But even on social proof, and you know, I could call us out on this directly, right? The people know who we are ahead of time. You have a YouTube channel. You have an Instagram. You have thousands of followers. There's your social proof. People are like, Nicholas, if you went to a clinic with Nicholas, this dude knows his shit. Because he has, I don't know what your number is. It keeps increasing, right? Every time I look at it, which is awesome. So it's one of these things like he has thousands of followers. Boom. I want to learn from him or I want to get a treatment from him. So there's already a bias of he's popular. And by association, if you hang out with them, you could be popular for your health. I know that sounds weird, but this is the thing people think in a clinical situation, right? And from there, he'll give me the treatment I exactly need because he has so much social proof with the numbers. And on top of that, I can connect with him anytime if I want to watch videos, right? Because, you know, we have a time portal here right now. It's like when you put up the podcast or when you do a video, everyone's like, I could always watch those and you could keep streaming with them. So it's like you're with them, but you're not with them. And that's absolutely brilliant if that's content creation processes. Like I've had people come in and be like, yeah, we've listened to your podcast. We've listened to Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole. We watch your YouTube videos on Qigong. It's like, you've been there the whole time. I'm like, yeah, because I am there the whole time because I spent the time there. And it's a one-on-one interaction now.
I'm trying to think if there's other ways to like establish social proof or I guess like reputation, like one-on-one. But I guess it's kind of like the social aspect like requires other people to be there.
Well, it also, yeah, it absolutely requires. So this is where if you're working in a multidisciplinary clinic, right, like that might be a reality for most people. You should know the practitioners. The practitioners should know you. That's referral networks now, right? So that is a social proof also. Someone refers to you, they go to you. But I remember even when I was first starting back in the day, it's like, okay, I might have worked with the chiropractors, but people would see me kind of joking around with all the practitioners and they're like, oh, Zach's talking to the chiropractors. Zach's talking to the naturopaths and everyone seems to like him. That's already social proof, right? If a client sees that. So that's working with people, but social proof by default says you need other people around you and you need to be seen with other people. So if you're more of a solitary person, your social proof has to come through online content. It has to come through reviews. It has to come through referrals. Unless you have like, you know, these workshops and things, you're like, hey, this is Chinese medicine. Here's the five elements. And they see five people in the room there, right? But you can work with the staff to build this.
But something I think we maybe alluded to earlier is this idea of qualifying people. And I think this is one of the things that definitely comes up in dating, where it's very easy that at first you're like, I want to date anybody with a pulse. Anybody that comes through, my goal is to get anybody through the door. It doesn't matter. I just need to get those numbers up. And eventually you get to you realize that that's not actually a great strategy. You might need to like actually say no to people in order to say yes to higher quality people. And is that something you find yourself doing in practice, that you screen people or turn away people that you say, maybe this isn't for you. Maybe my style isn't for you. Maybe you'd be better off seeing this MD with a white lab coat, or maybe you'd be better off seeing this barefoot hippie. Is that ever a strategy you take?
Right. So there are times, I mean, generally from a clinical perspective, we take everyone. That's the way I've been trained. You accept everyone because everyone comes from denominations of life. But now we get into another dirty secret about Chinese medicine. Most people are going to reflect where you're at. That's the freaky thing. So if you're having issues in your life, you're going to find people with those issues coming to you. And you either have a solution to it or you don't. You're going to have to figure out a solution ideally. And the patterns that you have are usually the patterns your clients have. So this gets back to this resonance idea. But in reference to saying no to things, yeah, you're going to have to say no. Like you might just say, hey, like I'm pretty good across the board. That's just the way I'm trained. But if I'm not seeing certain results, I'm just going to cut them and say like, sorry, we're not on the same page and I'm not able to get any results for what we're looking for you, unfortunately. So, you know, I might do a referral out. Usually I don't do referrals out given the way I've trained, just because I'm able to cover majority of things, but there have been a few times where I'm like, this just ain't working. And, I'm sorry I couldn't help you on this, but here's some lifestyle recommendations. But again, it's usually one of those things where it's a take it or leave it with me. It's like, you kind of know what we're about. By the time you came in, you probably know everything about us. You've already probably read our website probably for at least 15 minutes. We are not your everyday clinic. So like we really do talk about this classical aspect, the spiritual aspect of Chinese medicine. And if that's not what you're about, and you just want to fix a shoulder pain, I could work on that. But if it's a deep rooted issue, then maybe not. Like I remember I working with some clients and they have issues. And I literally said, this is a problem with a relationship right now you have. I literally called them out on it. They reflect and they're like, absolutely, you are correct. And this person was blood deficient, right? So then I said, okay, why don't you love yourself? Like, these are the type of conversations I have with clients. Now, do you think someone that has an MSK problem or musculoskeletal problem cares about why they have a shoulder pain? Probably not, right? So I kind of let the client lead on this and say, we will accept anybody, but there is going to be a certain point that if I'm not getting the results for the client, then that is a refer out because I can't best serve them anymore.
Yeah, and I guess to some extent you do have some pre-screening set in there. Like when people see your website and see pictures and see the clinic, that might give them some idea and it might screen out people automatically. Absolutely. Through that process. I'm trying to think, like, the times I've done that, it's usually been like there's somebody who's pregnant or wants to get pregnant. And I think that's just my own personal thing. I don't like dealing with that. So I'm like, maybe you should go see Karen. Like, she's been pregnant before. She deals with a lot of fertility stuff. She has a good network with the Diaper Fairy Cottage and things like that. So I'm going to be like, you're probably better off. I can treat you, but you might be more comfortable seeing Karen.
Well, absolutely. And this is like having a strong referral network, knowing who to send. So like my master medical qigong person I learned from, Robert Young's, late Robert Young's, I should say, like he was the person I used to send for cancer clients. He was like the oncology, like you want to do medical qigong in Eastern U.S. and Canada. He was the one that trained you. Right. So, I mean, he gave me the highest title on that. So I'm continuing that lineage with him. With everything. However, he was an oncology person, and when he was alive, I was like, I'm not dealing with oncology. He told me it was tough. Don't take it, right? Now that, you know, he's not around anymore, unfortunately, this is where who's on the block? It's only me, right? So this is where I know how to deal with cancer and oncology clients. It's a rough place, but there's no one else to refer to. Mind you, I do have the skill sets to train it based on the training I have from my master, Andrea Vimes, and then Robert. So this is where, again, those are rough clients. Like, oncology is a rough area to deal with. I'll be the first one to say that. But initially, I was referring out saying, this ain't my shtick. Now it's all my shtick, right? So you'll find that it changes, too, depending where you are in life and depending who your contacts are.
So another one, and this might be a little bit controversial, but one of the things I remember reading about was this idea of if you're going to ask somebody out, it's important about like how you frame that question. And to some extent, it's almost a don't ask, just make statements instead of questions. So like instead of saying like, oh, you know, maybe if you're not busy, do you think that maybe sometime you'd like to get together if it's not a big deal? Like, that doesn't work very well.
No, it doesn't.
Maybe a better approach would just be like, don't even ask, make statements and saying like, I think you're a really cool person. I'd like to get together sometime to get to know you better. And that's maybe a better approach. And I feel like this is another thing that comes up in a clinical aspect. Is I've seen students do the same thing where they're like, oh, do you think that you want to come back next week? Maybe it's actually, that's not a good way to do it. A better way to do it is say, hey, I think we made some really good progress today, but as you know, we can't get everything done in the first treatment. I'd like to see you once a week for the next 4 weeks, and then shut up and wait for them to say something.
Yes. And this is where it gets into, it goes back to our frame control conversation. Are you confident? And again, we keep using the word confident, but it's really, are you comfortable with what you're doing? So this is where even if a, would you like to come back, or would you like to come back? It's like the tone, it's like one's a statement, even though it's worded as a question. One is actually a question and you're like, I'm unsure about myself. So this is where the general rule about this when I was working with people was downtone every single time. You can ask a question and it'd be like, do you like Pokemon? And it's like, is that a question or is that a statement? At that point, it's like, I like Pokemon. Thank you very much. It's right. It's boom. So the tone, actually, tonalities make a difference. So this is where, honestly, I would say get in front of a mirror, do some acting classes, do some improv. It makes a difference for you to think on your feet, especially if you're more of an introverted person. Because it's unnatural. Like if you're an extrovert, you'll be like, YOLO, it's a fun time. It does not matter. But as an introvert, it's weird. You're like, because you're kind of like, you want to save time for yourself. You're like, why am I doing this for other people? Because I could play video games. I could be reading a book. I could be doing something. It's just how you recharge your batteries. But because of that lack of exposure as an introvert, your skills in certain departments aren't there. So you have to train it up some other way. So this is where downtones are usually an easy crutch as a first point. Second point I would say here, generally speaking, is going to be cut out your these fluff words.
Yeah.
These definitive fluff words that everyone does. The more succinct you can make your language, the better it's going to be. And from there, shorter phrases are better phrases. The shorter the phrase, the bigger the gap. Because silence is uncomfortable for most people. So at the point that you can do silence, it's saying, I'm here all day. I could sip the tea, I could sip the coffee. It does not matter. It is awkward. Silence is awkward. But if you are comfortable with silence, people are naturally want to fill it in. And the more they invest into the conversation, the more attached they are to, well, essentially having a conversation with you, and the more enrolled they are in whatever you're proposing. So with students in a clinic where they say, well, you know, do you want to come back next week? I'd say, you know, it's as you were saying, you can change the phrasing. So let's have you come back next week, right? And so it's just, it's an assumption. It's done. You're coming back next week, and this is why. I'm telling you why exactly you're coming back. Because if you just say, come back next week, people are like, why am I coming back? Like, you don't want them to think, right, in this context. So you say, hey, come on back next week. I have a treatment plan involved. This is what it is. But even during the treatment, I mean, this is where, what are you doing on the table? Are you having a conversation with them? Is it pure silence? I'll tell you, I'm very conversational on the table, but I let the person lead. If they ask me questions, I'm talking to them, and they're like, what's your story? I'm like, what story do you want? From what chapter? Because it's a novel. And they're like, what? And then we get into it. However, I am peppering the conversation throughout the time where it's like, well, you know, I think this is going to be probably this much. So I'm already pre-warming them in some ways in the conversation, which, you know, from a dating perspective, when we go back to dating coaching, you would get them to imagine the future with you. This is like the, I forget the particular term in psychology, but you're basically getting them to imagine what it's going to be like, because once they imagine it, it's already happened. Because now you have all these unanswered questions and it strikes curiosity. At the point you have a curiosity point and you said, hey, I want to do this with you. Can you imagine doing this? Right? This is when we start getting to the fun stuff of healing. Remember, medicine and magic were not separate for the most of historical time, up until basically like the more modern era, which means, like, if we looked in the Western conversation of things, Hermes, god of trickery, god of commerce, god of sales, was still the medical god. So you still have to get them to imagine things and what would be happening in the future. And that's just a nice trick to do, because you could say, well, what would it be like in three sessions? I'm giving, like, you know, you might say, I think this is going to take 10 sessions or so. I'm going to do my best to help you on this particular point. And this particular point is, let's just say, shoulder pain. This shoulder pain, I think it's going to be 10 sessions because you've had a long time with this. You've had over a month. Over a month, we're going to say it's chronic from Chinese medicine standards. So with that, today we worked on the large intestine. This is about boundaries. We talked about certain things. You felt the difference as soon as you rolled your shoulder a few times. And as you moved it, like right now, you can move your shoulder and you can feel that even loosen up right now. And they're like, oh yeah, it's even looser now. And it's like, yeah, see? So imagine what this would be like in a few sessions from now. I'm not guaranteeing that this is going to be completely gone, but we'll definitely make some progress. And we'll probably do a similar treatment. How's that sound? Right? So this is kind of like you're getting them to imagine ahead of time of what things are, or even on the table where I'll get, again, I'm just going to be peppering though and saying like, hey, this seems pretty chronic. Like, I think we're going to need some more sessions with this. But by the time we get to that sell pitch at the very end, you've already done essentially all the work. It's just for them to say yes, which now gets into things like a yes ladder, as they call it. The more they say yes, the more they want to keep going with the yes. So that's definitely a different psychology point, though.
But something I've been kind of struggling with around this area is, when you phrase things this way, to what extent are you taking away consent? Like, if I said, like, if I wanted to needle Ren 2 and I need to get them to unbutton their pants to do Ren 2, I could say, are you comfortable with me doing this point? Yes or no. Or I could say, you know, there's this point, Ren 2, it's right above your pubic symphysis. I'd really like to do this point. I think it'd be really good for you. Are you okay with that? And I feel like making the statement and saying, are you okay with that? I'm more likely to get a yes, but is it I'm circumventing their ability to consent? I mean,
not really. I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying. It's kind of like, okay, so we're doing all these conversational tactics using body language, using a lot of psychology. Is this a good thing or a bad thing for them at this point? Right? So this now comes down to a question of, they always have consent. They always have consent. They could say no. However, would you even propose it if it was a bad idea? That's also the other thing, right? Like, you know, we get into these things that people are like, well, we don't want to manipulate people. But the thing is, you're manipulating people all day, whether you believe so or not. So this gets into a whole trigger area for people where they say, well, no, I'm not manipulating people. I'm just being honest with them. I'm having a conversation with them. I'm like, well, conversations are communication. Communications means everyone's ideas and statements and worldviews are coming into a certain point. So now it's saying, well, who has a stronger frame of things in particular? Because, you know, you manipulate the coffee to make coffee drink, right? those beans, did they have consent? Like, this gets into these types of conversations, and that's a whole rabbit hole. However, everyone always has the right to say no. And this is why we always establish that all the time in the clinical setting, saying like, well, you know, I think this is a good idea, but here's the consequences. If you don't want to do this, that's perfectly fine. Like, I'll give it to them and say, like, this is the treatment I'm going to do. How's your day? These are consequences if we don't do it. So they can have a full understanding across the board. It's not like I'm withholding the information.
And I guess this is like an interesting ethical conversation to me, where even if we're just getting into things like NLP, it's like there are things you can do that will influence a person's behavior. And you get into questions of, is that ethical? And I've heard a lot of the NLP people saying, well, it's all about intentions. If you have good intentions, if you use language in such a way that they're more likely to do, take the course of action that you want, it's all about your intentions. Do you have good intentions for them? And I'm always kind of like, that's a nice story to tell yourself, but it's also like you're making a lot of money. You're making money when these people come back. You have a selfish interest that I need to pay my rent. I need to get this person to come back. And so if I use these tactics to influence them to come back, is that still ethical? And then I get into this other side. Well, it's like once the cat's out of the bag, you can't put it back in. Like once I have this knowledge that if I say this sentence this way, one thing is more likely to happen. If I say the sentence this other way, they're more likely to come back for a second treatment. It's like at this point, I have to choose one or the other. And so.
Right. And this is where it comes down to.
I don't get to claim ignorance anymore.
It is very much like that. But I would say it's like, is it the knowledge piece? Like this gets into like this apple and eating conversation. It's like people have been doing this every single day, even before the conversation we had. People would act a certain way. Like if someone's sad, what are you doing? You might empathize with them. If someone's happy, you like, this is where these are natural behaviors that we're already doing. The difference is, you know, when people are like, oh, it's a nice narrative and, you know, how are you presenting? It's like, it's good intentions. I'd be like, then you better check yourself. This is some Spider-Man stuff. Great responsibility, great powers, right? And this is the thing. I mean, I could talk easily about hypnosis. If people don't want to be hypnotized, they're not going to be hypnotized. It's very obvious, right? So people are like, oh, they do this trade show stuff and they use hypnosis. Those people want, from a certain level, they value being in front of people. They've already self-selected themselves. So it's the same thing with your clients. The difference is, are you working them toward healing or not? Anything that detracts from their healing and fixing whatever problem they have, I would view as a hindrance. Because they already came in with enough trust and confidence and belief that you can maybe do something. At the point that you are starting to put up your own obstacles because your communication is bad or your area looks horrible or whatever it is, it's basically, now for the accounting people here and more engineer searches, it's debits and credits. How many pluses can you get? Because they already have a story of you already. It's whether or not you're fitting into their story now. And this now gets into people who are like, what? I'm an independent person. I should don't fit in anybody's story. It's like, no, they have a preconstruction of you already. They have a preconstruction of Chinese medicine already. You are just a replacement. For all intents and purposes, it could be anybody for the first time. It does not matter. They don't know who you are. So this is where they've already had the narrative in your head. The question is, are you going to make the narrative stronger or weaker? And that's where it comes down to, you know, are you pre-qualifying all these other things? But the narrative's already there, right? So the manipulation's already there, but they've already done their self-manipulation to get you there for whatever reason. So this is where I think it comes down to, is it working against the narrative that they have formed, or is it working with the narrative that they have formed? My general take is work with their narrative. And this is where, once you understand that, the manipulation pieces or the influence piece is, it's a default behavior now. It's just whether or not you're working with them, because ethically, your goal as a healer is to heal, right? I mean, let's be honest. If people want money out of this, this is not the right industry. Yeah. So you can't make a good bunk with this, but like literally you have one job in this. So if I'm hindering or if someone's hindering the narrative of healing, then what are you doing?
So maybe a good way to round this out is we've talked about a lot of ways to establish rapport, eliciting values, mirroring and leading, social proof, maintaining frame, using the words and body language and things like that. But I think one of the ways that dating is different from seeing a patient is that if you're dating someone, like your goal is to break down all the boundaries and get as close as possible. With a patient, you kind of have this push and pull of you want to establish rapport, you want to establish a connection, but you also need to maintain appropriate boundaries. Do you have any advice on that of how do we create this connection but not have it get creepy?
That's a good question. Yeah.
Because I was going to say, like, there's the whole don't date your patients. And it's like, yes, you should never ask out your patients. But I've had plenty of cases where the patient tried to ask me out and it ended up in us terminating the patient relationship just because they were too embarrassed to come back in again. So I feel like this is a thing we need to be aware of.
Right. Absolutely. And this is where how chummy do you get with your clients? I think that's one of the things. Like, this is why I say, like, you should have scripts. You should have your pre-planned things ahead of time. I'm not going to talk to my patients and be like, here's my partner. This is my life problem with my partner. I'm not talking about those details. You know what I'm going to talk about? You know, I watched a movie. Right? Like, that's appropriate. But it's not in-depth. And usually the steering of the conversations is how does this help them in their medical pieces? So it's like my context of a practitioner is I am a storyteller. And in the story, I can relate to you my experiences within the concept of a story of Chinese medicine, but it's still geared to you and how this actually applies to you directly. So even though I might be doing a lecture on TCM stuff with them, it's based in Chinese medicine only. So like, you know, I might know a little bit of their life, they know a little bit about mine. But they know generally the themes are this shoulder has this relationship issue with you. And this, you know, if you have chest congestions or whatever it is, this is a narrative of you. I really keep it on them particularly. Now, this gets into things like transference, right? But if you keep it on their narrative and let them talk it out, they're probably going to understand that if you keep hitting the medical points and keep referring back to the medical points, they know what this is about. And if people want to take it further on certain things, obviously, the premise socially is this is a medical treatment. Yes, we may talk about holistic things. Yes, we may talk about some made-up theory, right? Or whatever it is. It does not matter because they know the theme is I'm here for a medical treatment. This does apply to my life. How does this apply to my life? Well, it's because of this, 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 and this. And you line it up every single time in your sessions because they come in, they come in with a problem, you heal the problem with them, and then you remind them, hey, remember this? This is a medical treatment. And they're like, oh, yeah. So they can feel amazing, and they still know the context. So you just reinforce the context more and more.
Okay, so it sounds like we're saying reinforce the medical context, keep it medical, and maybe keep the story focused on them, that they're the main character in the story.
They're the main character, and you could pepper certain things in, like, you know, people ask me, like, hey, Zach, how's your day going? I'm like, it's all right, you know. And then I might say certain things, like, once I started talking about classical theory, people were like, oh, you're this. I'm like, yeah, well, this is kind of what we're about. You don't have to be about it, but this is my lens, and this is what we're doing. This is why I'm getting better results than other people. So understand, you don't need to buy this belief system, which becomes a disqualifier and qualifier at the same time in some ways. I say, this is what I do. You don't have to change anything you do, but the results should speak for themselves, right? That's usually where, again, I'm very results-driven. I'm pretty much like, does it work or doesn't it work? If it doesn't work, I have to look at myself and ask me some harder questions on my diagnosis, my needling point protocols, whatever it is. And then from there, that's how you demark things, particularly from client to practitioner relationship.
I think we're getting to the point where you have to get back and treat patients. Any other things you want to discuss?
I mean, I could go on and on. So it really is just like, this is kind of like, you know, this is one of my passions around psychology, communication skills. So I could go anywhere with this. As a takeaway, though, it's one of these things where I'd say, start reflecting on yourself. I know everyone's like, go reflect on yourself. But I'm like, no, really. Reflect on your language. Literally take a tape recorder and say, what do you say? Are you like, oh, it's like this, and you got the whole Valley Girl thing going? Well, that's not quite professional. But are you going for professional?
Review the game footage. Don't just play it in your head. Actually review the game footage.
Right, because your memory is a horrible thing in particular, right? Like, you are going blind spot and take out certain narratives that don't fit you. So understand, like, this takes a lot of planning ahead of time from a clinical point. It's saying, who are you? What are your values? What do you want to represent for the healing here? I think that's the first thing. Then script out the things. Like, literally write out your stories and say, like, all right, what got you into Chinese medicine? Well, I didn't want to do Chinese medicine initially. I was a dating coach. It just seemed better to me at some level because the logic was blah, 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 blah. Okay, that's a script. It's true. Except now I could spit this out at any point I want, and the emotions with it, the experiences I have, they're all real. However, I could pull that up every single time. So this is one of the things you can do. Write out your scripts and the stories you're going to relate to clients with. Change your vocabulary. The vocabulary change is now going back to your values. At our studio, we serve everybody. So it's assuming I can work with everybody based on their life premises, right? I've had, you could say, a plethora of life come through here. It doesn't matter what their views are. I work with everybody. So at that point, I script certain things like, yes, I am an artist. I am a musician. I am all these other things that generally, like, you know, this is where I say get life experience. It's a weird thing to say to people, but it's like, get life experience. If you want to relate to people, you have to. You don't need a lot of it, but you need a little bit about it. So maybe you're sick of cooking. Well, maybe you talk about cooking and be like, I'm not the best. Right? This is why I prefer eating it. Whatever it is, right? Like, it seems jokey, but it is, like, now you're getting to this comedy sketch side of things. Like, know your routines. Know the timings of them. From there, look at your actual environments that you're in. What is the story narrative you're trying to create with the people? Right from the door all the way to the table. And what is the table experience you're trying to do? Are you needling and just saying, YOLO, I'm out of here. I threw my needles in. Bye-bye. I'm an awesome acupuncturist. Are you the person that's sitting with them and having a conversation about their life? Those are two different experiences. Are you doing some, like, I don't know, some hardcore, like, Chinese stuff where you're like, feel the chi and here's the moxa, blow it up. Like, I don't know. Like, those are very different experiences. If you're not a showy person, you pulling out the moxa stick and be like, boom, like, it's not going to happen, right? So this is kind of like, you have to be honest with yourself where your capacity is and how comfortable you are expanding your personality too, right? So, like, I saw, like, even on the narrative storytelling pieces, I found completely brilliant. I can't remember the show. It's like Be the Best or something like that. Some Korean drama about an acupuncturist. He's from, like, I don't know, like 14th century Korea. He ends up going to modern times through some time transport. And then he ends up falling in love with some cardiac surgeon or something like that. But the point is, like, he gets to the medical Chinese TCM Korean medicine hospital. And people are like, this dude's a genius. But he doesn't know things like blood thinners. So he basically, like, oh, this person has polyps and things in the nose, and he's telling them the story. But there's a show aspect to it. If you're not showy, you can't do this. But I looked at that, I'm like, this is brilliant, right? Because he went through a whole narrative structure with the person. It's like, oh, I got nose points. I can't smell anything. He's like, I got you. He's like, what do you mean you got me? Because he's like some famous doctor from back in the day. So he has that idea. He's like, I will open up your nose through the lightning channel with, like, lung. And he starts giving you these names. And he's like, and he puts a narrative. He's like, and we have to blow the wind out of you. So I'm going to hit this point at the back of your head to get the bad wind out. So you can then smell the fragrance from your nose. And he's hitting the needles at the same time he's saying the names of the points. And you're like, I'm like, whoa, this dude. But then I look at that, I'm like, I kind of do that. So, I mean, I have a little bit of a showman side. So it is fun for me when I can do that. But honestly, if you're not that, you can't do that. So this is what, like, what's the experience of you and the client now? Because that's fun to me. And if, I mean, this sounds kind of corny, but it's like, if you're not having fun and you're not enjoying yourself, the clinic is going to burn you out and you will be gone within a few years. I guarantee it. So this is, you know, me being like that, it's a little more fun. But most of the time, it's kind of like, hey, how's your day? What are you doing? What's life? and it's kind of like a kickback type of effect. So build in the enjoyment with it. I think that's one of the key pieces. So really is recap is know your stories, know what your values, know the type of qualified clients you're going for to see if they're the right type of clients for you, build the experience from start to scratch, and then have fun. And then finally, from a booking standard, it's just, you're coming back. This is awesome. This is a fun time. It's like, we don't even have to view it from a date. View it like a play date when you're a kid. It's like, do you want to go to Sandbox with them again? Sure. So at that point, I think it's going to be this much treatments, and we can go forward with that. How does that sound? Because now this is like, that is a consent still. You're giving them the game plan. And by giving them the game plan, they could say yes or no, but they've already seen the results you can do because you've trained as a practitioner. So the more they believe in you, the more they can believe in their own healing. And you're just a vehicle for that healing. And that becomes a bigger piece, I think.
Yeah, and I think the having a script thing is important, because I'd always tell people, like, you need a script of how do you explain the needles. When somebody asks, what does acupuncture do? You need a script of a short, concise way to explain this. What is qi? What are you doing in this treatment? You need to have those scripts so you can just rattle them off without thinking. And so I think this is a good idea to have those scripts around your stories and your values so you can rattle them off in the same way. So I like that. You mentioned you have your own podcast and YouTube channel as well.
Yep. So, YouTube channel, that's the Wuji Xuan. You just look it up. You'll have those Qigong videos there. Podcast as usual, Deeper Down the Rabbit Hole. So you have that, for more people into the spirituality / magic side of things. So we go no holds barred, my master and I, Andrea, we're just like, this is how you do it in real life. And we don't really hold back. So that's where it's like, we generally say results over image. So we do have that. People want to support us for the workshops we do. We have workshops online, that's hybrid. And we got a lot of goodies. You just have to look at wujishuan.ca, queencitycurio.ca. Those are going to be the websites for either you're interested in the spirituality side of things or you're in the wellness side of things.
Yeah, and we're working on a 4-needle technique class. Maybe we can just say that's in the works right now. It'll be coming up eventually. That was one of the more popular podcast episodes where I think I did a video that was just explaining, here's how you do it in terms of if you have to answer a question on boards, here's maybe how you get to the correct answer. But then later we did a podcast where we went more into the actual clinical applications of that. So that's something we'll be expanding into a course. So you can keep an eye out for that. Go back and watch some of the older YouTube videos and podcast episodes about that. But we're working on a course for that, so you can look forward to that in the next couple months.
Yep, definitely going to be a fun full-day course on that one, so keep your eyes out.
Awesome. Zach, thanks for being here. Thanks for spending your lunch hour with me.
Thank you, Nicholas. Always a pleasure.
This episode can be downloaded at podcast.tcmstudy.net/session22. As always, special thank you to the Patreon members for supporting this podcast, the YouTube channel, and the website tcmstudy.net. If you would also like to support this work, you can head on over to podcast.tcmstudy.net and click the donate button in the upper right corner, or just look for the Patreon link in the show notes. Also, be sure to check out the links to Dragon Blood Balm and Evil Bone Water. But that's all for today. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.